It is Hawaii Public Radio, all things considered. I'm Dave Lawrence, and today we're getting a rare chance to speak with a legendary Canadian musician. He is playing this Friday and Saturday night, 7 p.m. shows at the Blue Note. It is Bruce Cockburn, and we are thrilled to welcome him to All Things Considered right now. Aloha and welcome, Bruce. Thank you so much for doing this.
Thanks very much. It's nice to be with you.
Sometimes you play with a band, but right now I understand this is part of a solo tour. Talk a little bit about how with over 30 records and so much material that lends itself to solo performance, what's in store for folks?
Well, I haven't really completely decided yet, but for any given tour, I kind of come up with a repertoire that includes a bunch of the stuff from whatever the current album is, and then a cross-section of older material that varies from tour to tour, varies from a little bit from night to night, especially in a solo situation.
You're this kind of dude who not only do you have a lot of cool kinds of songs, but your guitar playing attracts a lot of people. And I don't know how old you were exactly, but you found a guitar in your grandmother's attic, and that sort of led to what is still feeding and taking care of you all these years later, which is making guitar your career.
Yeah. I mean, I was really interested in playing guitar. The music that I was excited by was the first rock and roll, which was all about guitar. So I wanted to play guitar and sort of hadn't done anything about that. But at one point, the family was having a new house built, and of course, it wasn't ready on time. So we stayed at my grandmother's house for a couple of months in a cupboard, a closet under the eaves in this little attic room. I found a guitar case. I opened it up, and there's a guitar inside. My heart started beating fast. It's like, ooh, you know, and I didn't know anything about how to play it. And it was set up to play Hawaiian, set up with the high nut so that you could lay it on your lap and play it with the steel.
Wow.
Then my parents said, if you want to play guitar, you can do that, but you have to promise two things. You have to promise that you'll take lessons and learn to do it properly, and you have to promise you won't grow sideburns and get a leather jacket. So I said, okay.
Tough conditions.
And yeah, really. I mean, you know, they paid for guitar lessons and badgered me to practice, and little by little, the guitar began to consume, I wouldn't say my whole life, but certainly my sense of what it was I wanted to do with my time.
Senior year in high school, your yearbook said that your goal was to be a musician, so clearly it had pushed you into that kind of direction by then. How soon after that were you busking on the streets of Europe? I read you took a boat there.
Yeah, that was right away. That episode of discovering the guitar happened when I was 14, so by the time I was 18, I had a handle on the instrument. I wouldn't say I was a good player, but I could play. I had fallen in with some folkies, discovered the world of finger picking, and when I went to Europe, the excuse was I was going to go visit a Swedish friend I had met the summer before when he came to visit Ottawa, where I grew up. So I got a freighter from Montreal to Norway.
Wow.
And then took the train to Stockholm, and I spent a few weeks in Stockholm, and then my friend and I hitchhiked from there to Paris. I did a little busking along the way, and when I got to Paris, I met up with an American clarinet player and a French trumpet player. They'd been playing kind of Dixieland stuff together. You know, my little ragtime repertoire was close enough. They wrestled up a six-string banjo somewhere, which was loud enough to actually be heard playing with the clarinet and the trumpet. We played as a trio on the street. At that time, you had to have a license to play on the street in Paris, and so we were playing illegally, and they had already been shut down in most of the districts of Paris, but there were a couple left to we played in those until we got shut down in those, which we did. Very brief encounter with the police in Montmartre. three guys walking. We're sitting on the, if your listeners know Paris, there's the beautiful big staircase that leads up to the cathedral at the top of, or the basilica at the top of Montmartre. So beautiful August night, everybody's out there. We're sitting on step playing, and people are sitting listening, and then all of a sudden I become aware of, there's a pair of legs standing in front of me. I notice there's two other pairs of legs. So I look up, and just a bunch of guys, a guy wearing jeans, a guy wearing a sweater and a jacket. And the guy says, let me see your papers. And I said, who are you? and the French guy, the trumpet player, elbowed me hard. And then I realized that the guy in the jeans had a pistol sticking out of his hip pocket. And I was like, oh, I guess these are cops. So, you know, they sure enough were. So they made us go with them to the Montmartre police station, and we ended up spending a large chunk of the evening standing there and didn't charge us in the end with anything, but they kind of made noises as if they were going to do terrible things, you know. Right. So, you know, it was a bit of an adventure.
That's so funny, because this is like a cat who would, your college experience, you go to play in Berkeley, at the famous Berklee College of Music, and it's ironic because after all this busking, in Harvard Square, were people doing that? Because when I was there in the 90s, that was like this huge thing, a lot of busking in Harvard Square. I mean, that was the scene of Harvard Square. It was not like that.
No, it wasn't. Wow. Allowed to. The cops would come and chase you away. They didn't arrest you, but they'd chase you away. It was a very good experience being there. And in the end, I dropped out and joined a rock and roll band.
Yeah, that's the funny part of it. But that's how a lot of Berklee, as you probably know, that's a lot of heavy-duty cats like you go there and they don't finish it.
Yeah, even then, the story was that if you were any good, you would get hired before you finished your schooling.
Right.
It's true of a lot of people. I mean, John Abercrombie was in my class, and he...
Wow.
He dropped out, but he got hired by somebody famous. That wasn't my case. I dropped out because I realized that my path lay elsewhere. I wasn't sure where, but not there.
After school, you opened for both Hendrix and Cream. Did you get anything out of like seeing Clapton and Jimmy up close like that, or get to talk to him, or have anything formative come of those two?
I didn't talk to Clapton. There was no opportunity to do that. But when we opened for Hendrix in an arena in Montreal, everybody was invited to a party afterwards at a recording studio. I stayed and heard the show, but then, you know, we just sort of beat it over to this place. And there were a few, what seemed like the hipper than thou people kind of lurking in the shadows in this room. And they had a little stage set up with instruments. People drifted in. Nobody was interested in us at all. But then Mitch Mitchell and
Noel Redding
came in. Yeah, I ended up talking to Noel Redding. Hendrix wasn't there yet. They got in first. Everybody perked up, and they were all looking at him, you know, and he happened to just be standing next to me, and he was telling me that they had just done 31-nighters in a row by air.
Wow.
And I can't imagine. I mean, they smelled bad. Their clothes were in rags, but they were pretty cool clothes. Then Hendrix came in, and the room went silent, and everybody's looking at him. And he was standing next to me and Noel, and he sort of turned to me and he said, "I don't know what all the fuss is about, man. I just want to play some music." We also opened for Wilson Pickett one night, and we hardly had any gigs at all, but the ones we had were pretty memorable.
And the thing about you is also a lot of huge artists love your stuff. And Jerry Garcia, he would just pour himself into it, waiting for a miracle. And whether it's Jimmy Buffett, Judy Collins, Dan Fogelberg, you go full circle and you think of your music has made such a huge impact on guys like that. I mean, does the Jerry thing, did that touch you?
I was very flattered and moved that any of those people did my songs. I mean, when I first started writing songs, I imagined I would write songs and other people would record them. And I thought of people like Judy Collins. But it became clear very quickly that no one was interested in doing my songs. And if I wanted anybody to hear them, I'd better get out and sing them myself.
Right.
So that's what I did. Never paid much attention to the idea that other people might record them. But after a while, other artists started getting interested in doing them. And it's always interesting to hear what people will make of them. Jerry Garcia was famous for being a little creative with other people's lyrics. My song was no exception. When I heard his version of it, the recorded version, it was like, what? You know, what? What did he say? What? And the music was great, but what I was a little bit put off by with, you know, changes in the lyrics. Then I realized the next thing on the record, I think, was a Dylan song, and he changed all the lyrics for the Dylan song too. So then I didn't feel so bad.
Right.
If he was doing it with everybody, then I, you know, I could go back to being just flattered.
Right.
I got to meet him not too long after that. The Dead were playing at Madison Square Gardens. They were doing a week there, and it was opening night, and between the soundcheck and the show, they took me to meet Jerry, and he was meditating in a tent at the back of the stage. We had to wait till he was prepared to receive guests. And then after a while, he came out and he said, hi, he shook my hand. He was very warm and friendly. And he said, oh, man, nice to meet you. You know, great song. And he said, I hope I didn't mess up the lyrics too much. And I said, well, I was going to wait till the second time I met you before I brought that up. But, you know, it's fine. You did it your way, you know, and I'm glad you did. So thank you. But it was just funny that he
brought it up.
You know, he was aware of his own reputation in that regard.
Yeah. Some great storytelling. It's Bruce Cockburn and joining us on All Things Considered. So grateful we got to talk to you.
Yeah, it's very nice to talk to you. I appreciate your interest.
Really loved all the stories, dude, and looking forward to the show, too. Thanks for being on with us today.
Thank you. Aloha, this is Bruce Cockburn, and I've waited a very long time to say these words. You and I are in the company of our friend Dave Lawrence.
Look at them working in the hot sun. Someone